The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Welcome to Science for the People. Today we'll be looking at the stories we tell about disease, how rumors skew public perception, and what, if anything, we can do to encourage more evidence-based decision-making in the realm of public health. Later on, we'll speak with Dr. Paul Offit about the current state of vaccination efforts in North America. But first, let's see what the study of folklore can tell us about how people react to outbreaks of disease. Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm joined by John D. Lee, who holds a PhD in folklore from the Memorial University of Newfoundland and currently teaches literature and composition courses at various Boston area colleges and universities. He's published in various genres, and he's here today to talk about his book, An Epidemic of Rumors, How Stories Shape Our Perception of Disease. Thanks for being here, John.
Thank you for having me on the air.
So you study folklore. Now, how is that different than studying literature?
Folklore and literature have a bit in common with each other. Folklore is, however, very specifically concerned with the traditions and expressions of culture, whereas literature is usually a very highbrow element, like if we're thinking of, for example, Shakespeare or the recently departed Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Mm-hmm. We are looking at things that are very formalized in a lot of ways, especially with most of the modern works mass-produced, whereas folklore is more concerned with generally the informal. However, we're still interested in the creative aspects of that. So there are significant crossovers in, for example, folk literature, where I could talk about myths, legends, fairy tales, folk tales, et cetera, that might appear in, say, a Gabriel Garcia Marquez book. But in literature, we're not necessarily looking at those elements. It's a different approach to roughly the same material.
So then you would use different methods?
You would. And a lot of folklore doesn't necessarily have to do with literature at all. That's one of the misunderstandings a lot of people have about the field, is when you ask somebody what's folklore, they tend to say, you know, Paul Bunyan stories or something along those lines, fairy tales. And that is a part of it. But folklore is also concerned with things that people believe, things that people make. Like if you make a wooden truck for your kid for Christmas, that would be a part of folklore because it's not something that's mass produced. It's something you've made with your hands. One of the more common definitions of folklore that we use comes from Dan Benamos, who said that it's artistic communication in small groups. And he then defines artistic communication as things that people do, make, say, or believe. So it's a very encompassing genre, a very encompassing field of study that can be used to look at pretty much anything out there. We're just looking at different aspects of those things than, say, a literature professor or an anthropologist or a historian would look at.
Well, there's also a focus on the experience-centered approach. What is that?
That's a hypothesis that came about as a result of David Hufford's work in the 1970s and 1980s, where he took a look at what was going on in folklore at that time, as well as in anthropology and a number of other fields, and says in one of his early papers that one of the major problems that he had with a lot of the ways that scholars were reacting to the stories that they were collecting from people was that they were discounting the opinions of the people themselves on what those stories meant. They would essentially steal the stories or the objects or whatever it was, take them back and study them sort of out of context in their labs, make up their own ideas about what these meant and didn't mean, and then would publish the papers. And so what Hufford said for this experiential approach is, how about we start treating these things as if they're not only real, but as if the opinions of the people who give us these things matter to us. And one of the large parts of the experiential approach is thus a great deal of communication with the person from whom you're getting the information, whether it be a story or a handmade object. If it's a quilt, why did you make this? What did it mean to you? And we get all of the contextual information that we possibly can. And that's why it's called the experience-centered approach. We want to know what the full experience of this thing is, rather than just what we might think it is. What do the people who actually experience this think about it?
Well, what about when those perceptions are in direct conflict with facts, let's say?
That's when it gets a little bit naughty, and you have to tread your way very carefully through the lines. And it depends, of course, on the researcher how it's going to work from that point on. But there is, for example, one of the earlier and one of the better books that deals with the differences between what the researcher believes and what the interviewee believes is Kieran Narayan's Mondays on the Dark Night of the Moon, I think it is. It's a collection of Himalayan foothill folk tales where Narayan spent quite a long time living with this family, collecting their tales from them, and then she took the tales back to her college and wrote about them for a long time and theorized about them, which is what most people do. But then one of the brilliant things that she did was she sent an early draft of her book back to the family and had the family read it. And the family outright told her on a couple of occasions, you've completely misinterpreted this. This is entirely wrong. And so Narayan then helped them write a retort and published that retort inside of her book on the opposite page so that you have, like on page 51, Narayan's opinion of what the story means, and on page 52, the family's opinion of what the story means. And you can see that there's a vast gulf between those two things that she just doesn't necessarily resolve. She just points out the researcher is not always right, and that's an important recognition that has to be made, especially when you're dealing with things like folklore. If I'm studying someone else's culture, tradition, society, I know far less about it than anyone else inside there. I'm the dumbest person in the room. And so I can't just assume that whatever my opinions are the most correct ones.
That approach seems to be in stark contrast to how we study science.
It can be, and it depends on what you're studying in science, of course. Part of science, I mean, as Stephen Jay Gould has said, really good science is self-correcting, that the reason that we thought the dinosaurs went extinct, the initial theory said that it was a comet, but then after more research, it was corrected to an asteroid. So there is that sense of self-correction inside of science. But with a lot of science, you're dealing with things where there, especially in that case, are correct answers or are at least really strong hypotheses that you could prove to within, say, 99.9% accuracy. Whereas if I'm just studying what does it mean when somebody tells this story when they're angry or when they're scared, like in a disease narrative, there's not necessarily one correct answer. If I want to know how a supercapacitor works and I want to build a better one, there are only so many ways to do that, and you can find a right way and a wrong way. But it's far more difficult when you're dealing with a belief system. What constitutes a right versus a wrong belief system? And as a lot of folklorists would say, that's not even a good question to ask about belief systems. They're not right or wrong. They are inherently, internally logical and correct. And what we tend to do is try to study those belief systems to understand why they are the way they are.
Well, now with this book, you've explored the SARS crisis from both perspectives.
I've tried to, from both the medical perspective and from the lay perspective, as I call it, the public perspective, looking at the differences between the stories that people tell, because there are vast differences between the narratives that doctors and that the medical journals tell about SARS or about any disease versus the kind of stories that just somebody taking the bus or walking down the street is going to tell about that, especially that a lot of the medical journals that I studied when I was looking at the SARS specifically were almost entirely devoid of not only humor but rumor. Very little of that whatsoever. It was entirely fact-based for the most part. What are the transmission vectors? What kind of disease is it? What can we do to prevent it from happening? Quarantines, vaccines, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas people, when they're walking down the street, are generally concerned with the same kinds of questions, especially the one, how can I not get this? But they're not thinking about it in terms of virus or bacteria and vaccine or et cetera. They're thinking about what are the stories that I've heard about this and who have I heard that supposedly has this? What part of the city is supposedly infected and how do I get away from it? And they're also telling jokes about it quite a lot. And those jokes don't appear in the medical literature.
This is Science for the People, and my guest is John D. Lee, author of An Epidemic of Rumors, How Stories Shape Our Perceptions of Disease. Okay, so the threads of disease narratives may not always precisely match up, but the disease narratives on the whole definitely seem to. You say that we see the same common themes, whether we're talking about SARS or AIDS or H1N1 or basically any type of disease that seems like it's going to be an epidemic?
Mm-hmm. We certainly do. That if you hold up these diseases, these narratives rather, up against each other and look at them, it's sometimes almost like you've taken a 50-year-old story about measles, took out the word measles, and inserted the whatever the name is of the most recent disease that everybody's worried about, and then you retell the narrative. And it makes sense that we do that in a lot of ways because, of course, whenever we have a new outbreak happening, something that's unfamiliar to everybody, as with SARS, for example, or with avian bird flu or any of the other sort of novel diseases that have come about recently, when you don't know something about these diseases, you go back to previous similar situations and try to use what you knew about that similar previous situation to construct a narrative that will help you deal with the current situation. And that's not just with disease narratives. That's a basic aspect of humanity. Whenever we encounter something new, we try to make sense of it by thinking about things that are like that thing. It just happens in disease narratives as well. And so we have a lot of disease narratives that get told over and over and over again over the course of dozens of epidemics. And it's the same narrative. We just rebrand it by inserting the name of the new disease.
Well, so give me an example of an epidemic-based recycling of the narrative, as it were.
A lot of them come about with the cures that that we talk about with diseases. That, for example, when you are starting off with a new disease that you don't know anything about, and you go back to the previous disease and you say, well, this vitamin seemed to do a pretty good job, or this herb seemed to do a pretty good job, a lot of people will then simply take that vitamin or that herb and start taking it for this disease as well. A number of the people who I interviewed for my book, for example, immediately upon the SARS virus being announced, went out to the store and bought bottles and bottles of vitamin C pills and just started popping them like candy because they made an association with vitamin C and health. And it was the same association that they'd made with previous disease outbreaks, that if you take your vitamins, it will strengthen your immune system and everything is going to be okay. Another example of this one is when we have a new disease outbreak, one of the unfortunately common things that happen is that we start trying to point a finger. And from the scientific perspective, that makes complete sense. If you have a new disease outbreak, you want to know where it came from so that you can start tracing it back to its origin. And if you can find its origin, maybe that will tell you something about how to stop it. But from the lay perspective, that becomes a problem because when you have a new SARS virus and scientists trace it back as having come from China, the first thing that everybody did in the SARS outbreak was start making racist, xenophobic rumors about the Chinese. And we did the exact same thing with the H1N1 virus a few years ago, where it came from Mexico. And I had quite a number of Latino friends who said the first thing that happened after scientists discovered that H1N1 came from Mexico is that people stopped sitting next to them on the buses. They would get in, sit down, and people would literally stand up and move over a couple of seats to get away from the Latinos because everyone knew, in air quotes, that they were diseased. Some of the informants I had during the SARS crisis said the exact same thing happened. My Asian informants would go and sit on a bus in, say, Toronto. People would get up and move away from them because they knew, in air quotes again, that they were sick. We had the MERS-CoV outbreak that started a couple of years ago in the Middle East. The exact same kind of racist and xenophobic rumors immediately arose. As soon as medicine said this seems to have come from the Middle East and Qatar, people on websites like CNN and Time, in response to these medical announcements, if you scroll down to look at the comments that people had left in the bottom, were leaving incredibly racist and xenophobic messages at the bottom saying, essentially, these people deserved it, these dirty, you know, ragheads, towel heads, et cetera, just putting as much negative feelings into those messages as they possibly could. So definitely the racism and xenophobia aspect of it is almost ubiquitous inside of disease narratives. Anytime there's something new that comes out, we want to know who's responsible for this, and then we start ostracizing that people. Look, going back to probably the most problematic epidemic of the modern era, the AIDS virus, when it first came out, after it was associated with homosexuals were the most horrible thing in the world for the 1980s because they were responsible for the AIDS outbreak. Ultimately, of course, we realized that it has little to do with homosexuality in general. It's just the sexual transmission of the disease. But that racism and xenophobia was present from the very beginning with AIDS, as it was with SARS, as it was with H1N1, as it will be with whatever the next disease that comes around.
So how else, in addition to avoiding people of certain ethnicities and avoiding specific places, how else were people trying to prevent SARS?
Prevent contracting SARS?
Yes.
A number of them were – a lot of them had to do with isolating themselves, with the quarantines, these self-quarantines. A couple of my interviewees reported essentially not leaving their homes for weeks at a time. One of my interviewees said one of his friends – didn't leave his house for somewhere between 6 and 8 months, I think it was. I'm not sure how he had his food delivered to him, but he didn't go out of his house. He didn't visit his barber for 8 months. And by the time the outbreak was over and he finally left his house, his hair had grown down to his shoulders. And he was normally like a crew cut kind of guy because he was just so terrified of going anywhere. So the isolation and the quarantine was a large part of it. But one of what I thought was the more interesting parts was the methods that people use to try and ward off the disease from either a medical perspective or almost like a magico-religious perspective. For the former, there were a lot of people who were taking vitamins or teas of various sorts, or were experimenting with herbal remedies of various kinds to try and keep the disease away or to ward it off or to cure themselves if they did catch it. But for the magico-religious part, I collected stories of people in China, for example, who were lighting firecrackers and burning money as sort of an offering to the gods to keep the disease away. There was a rumor that in China somewhere there was a child born with the ability to speak around the time that SARS arose, and the child only lived for a few hours or days, depending upon the version of the story, but before the child died, it warned everybody that there was a new outbreak coming. Something was on the horizon, and it was going to be terrible, and the way that you cure yourself is to eat mung bean soup. And during the SARS outbreak, mung beans were almost unable. You couldn't buy a mung bean in China because that rumor was so widespread and popular that everybody went down and stripped the stores of mung beans to make mung bean soup. As another example, there was also a rumor that if you had the ace of spades with Saddam Hussein's face pasted onto it, you would ward away SARS.
Now, does that even come from? That's an interesting one.
It was tied in with one of the rumors. It seems to be tied in anyway with one of the rumors that was going around about the origin of SARS, that we have the acronym SARS, Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. But one of the more common things that people do as sort of a joke is take those acronyms and make them stand for something else. And one of the appropriations that was made about that acronym was Saddam's awesome retaliation strategy. which was tied in with a conspiracy theory about the fact that Saddam Hussein or someone in his army had created SARS as a biological weapon and then had spread it all over the world to get back at us for whatever we did to him a couple of years earlier. And that then somehow if you had the Ace of Spades with his face on it, it would in this magical religious way ward off SARS. You were protecting yourself, you know, like making the sign of the cross or the evil eye at someone to ward off an evil spirit.
And on that note, we'll be right back with more of John D. Lee, author of An Epidemic of Rumors on Science for the People, after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with John D. Lee. He has a PhD in folklore, teaches literature and composition courses at a number of Boston area colleges and universities, and he's also the author of An Epidemic of Rumors, How Stories Shape Our Perception of Disease. All right, so you mentioned earlier that sort of the lay people and the media and the scientists and the medical professionals, they're all looking at this from kind of a different angle, and that, I assume, creates some friction.
It does. And one of the primary problems that results because of this is that the major source of information for the public is what comes to them through the media. And if you think of this as having three different levels, the public are the ones who receive the information, medicine is the one that creates that information, and media is the one that's responsible for transmitting that information. But all three levels of that rubric have entirely different communication styles. If you read anything out of a medical journal, it is incredibly terse language, large words, very specific scientific vocabulary and jargon. And if you don't know a whole lot about medicine, it can be incredibly difficult to follow along with because it is so incredibly focused and largely based on fact. Whereas you have the lay population who employ hundreds of thousands of different styles of communication, depending upon who you're talking to, what race, ethnicity, what level of education, what gender, etc. And then you have the media who is responsible for transmitting that. But the problem is that the media has arguably the simplest language out of all of those different levels. I'm fairly certain that I've heard some of my journalist students talk about they're essentially told to write for around a fourth grade level mm-hmm. inside of their newspapers. And so when you have a medical journal that you then transmit through a fourth grade reading level to a population, it's very strange what sometimes comes out of the other end. It sometimes reminds me of the game of telephone that young kids play where you stick 10 of them in a row and you whisper something into the first one's ear and then they whisper it into the second one's ear and so on and so forth. And by the time you get to the 10th child who is supposed to say aloud whatever the thing was that's been whispered in his ear, it doesn't resemble at all the thing that you whispered in the first child's ear. Just it's been so selectively changed as it's been transmitted that information has been lost. Where you tell the first child, for example, I want a Big Mac and fries for dinner. And then by the time it gets down to the 10th kid, he says something about we're going to McDonald's for lunch. And everything else has just been lost in the middle somewhere.
Well, is it also a problem that it seems that especially public and scientists, they're both looking for information and for data, but they have different definitions of what data is, right?
They have different definitions of data, and they also have different ideas of what constitutes relevant and appropriate data. That for medicine, it's very often the vectors, the transmission of it, where is it coming from, where is it going, how do we stop it, the sort of very clinical ideas that they have about it. Whereas for a person who's just sitting in their home worrying about it, It's more along the lines of, how do I keep this away from my family? And they're not necessarily so concerned in many ways about where it's come from or where it's going, so long as it doesn't come here. And it's a totally different level of idea of why this is a relevant or irrelevant story.
So now media is supposed to sort of translate between them, are they not? Those two parties?
Often discussed with especially like the 10 o'clock news or even CNN for a large part, is that they want sound bites. And if it doesn't fit into a 20 or 30 second sound bite, then sometimes it doesn't get aired. And so that becomes a problem when you're trying to give a lengthy explanation about something like I'm doing right now, and then the 10 o'clock news cuts it down to a 5-10 second segment. You're going to lose 95% of the information when you do that.
Well, and you also wrote about how we all find ways to mediate the fear and the uncertainty that we feel during these kind of outbreaks and epidemics and such, and how humor is one of the ways that we deal with it. So I want you to actually read one of the jokes that you included in your book, because I think that that is the best way to present many of the points that you've been discussing and you discuss in your book. It's in one neat little package, and it's funny. And we discussed this before the show, the joke about this little piggy. Maybe give us some context first.
First, a little bit of context. I did get this joke off of an online jokes website. I think it was funnyanddie.com, although it could have been something else along those lines. So this wasn't something I collected from an interviewee. I did collect other forms of humor from interviewees about this one. But this joke takes the very common children's rhyme I play with my three-year-old son, where you grab their toes, this little piggy went to market, this little piggy stayed home, but then puts it in the context of the H1N1 virus, because after it was discovered that it came from Mexico, it was for a while called the Mexican flu, until medicine sort of realized, wow, that's really dangerous for us to just put the ethnicity or a race of people inside of that title. We're just begging for racist and xenophobic responses to that one. And so for a while, they tried to call it swine flu before we ultimately settled on the acronym H1N1, which was void of any mention of ethnicity or animals or anything along those lines. So we have a play on the swine flu inside of here, this little piggy. The joke itself, this little piggy went to market, this little piggy stayed at home, this little piggy had roast beef, this little piggy had none, and this little piggy went cough, sneeze, and the whole world's media went mad over the imminent destruction of the human race, and every journalist found out that they didn't have to do too much work if they just did find bird replaced with swine on all their saved articles from a year ago, or all the way home.
I love that so much.
One of those lovely finds where it was just like, this is exactly what I needed to prove everything I was making. I couldn't have written a better joke.
That is exactly it. That's like the definition of recycling the narrative.
It is. And that's exactly what the joke comments on inside of there, brilliantly so, that sometimes it seems like these are literally recycled narratives. And that's why I call this an epidemic of rumors, that it's the same kinds of rumors in many cases over and over and over again. And it sometimes does seem like you're just using a find and replace function in your brain for the narratives that you heard about in the past, that some of the H1N1 stories sounded just like the H1N1 stories. We have the same kinds of conspiracy theories in every single outbreak I've looked at post 1970. There is always a rumor that it's a government conspiracy, that the government created it in a secret lab somewhere and released it either accidentally or purposefully onto the world. Thing was told about AIDS, that the CIA supposedly created AIDS in the 1980s. SARS was supposedly released by Saddam Hussein, or some other rumor said that it was released by our own government or by the Chinese government. There's a lot of these rumors that revolve around the various sort of typical conspiracy theory ideas that the Illuminati or the New World Order released it as part of a program to get rid of 3/4 of the human population so that we'll all submit to a one world government. It's the same kinds of stories over and over and over again. And you just take the word AIDS out and put the word SARS or H1N1 or MERS-CoV in, and you have the same but this time brand new conspiracy theory about, look what else the New World Order is trying to do to get to us now.
But then if one of our goals is, especially during an epidemic, if one of our goals is to try to get consistent, factual, up-to-date information out to a population, then this, everything you're talking about is terribly problematic. terribly. We have a number of different lenses through which people view the disease, and we have different agendas, and we have different definitions of data and how important they are. And then we have the inherent mistrust between some of the parties. So, to truly muddy the narrative waters, there's also been research that's been done on how rumors work, and it is not terribly reassuring.
It's very difficult to get people to stop telling rumors in many ways because the rumors are serving some sort of a purpose for these people, if for no other reason than they are an expression of fear and anxiety. And if you are worried about something, you're going to talk about it. And if you have no other thing to talk about that except for relating it back to something that you knew about a different disease, and that disease turned out to be from these people who you then didn't go near and you didn't get that disease, then it makes sense that in the next outbreak, you also find the people who are responsible and you stay away from them, and then you won't have to worry about it again. So it's not like the rumor is just a fanciful story that's being told by people. They're serving a purpose. It's people trying to keep themselves safe, however they can find a way to do it. And if that means isolating yourself, if that means staying away from the Latinos or from the Chinese or from whoever it happens to be this time around, they're going to tell the same story. They're going to do the same thing.
But unfortunately, a lot of those measures are spectacularly unhelpful. and they're actively detrimental, actually. So what should we do? Is there a clog to throw in the machine is what I'm asking. How can we stop that cycle?
Information seems to be one of the best ways to get this done. That if we simply talk about things like my book as much as we can, get people to recognize that there are patterns to these kinds of outbreaks and that some of them are damaging and that many of them haven't really served a larger purpose in some ways, or at least that they haven't necessarily made it better. They may have made it worse for large segments of the population, that it was strange for us to have Chinatown deserted in Boston when, to the best of my knowledge, I don't even know if there was a confirmed SARS case in Boston at the point in time at which Boston Chinatown was deserted. It was deserted because of a rumor that was spread that ultimately turned out to be completely false. So if we can then point out to people, here's what happened last time. You completely abandoned a large portion of the city based on something that wasn't real. Maybe when you hear these things next time, you should try to confirm it with a more reliable source than your neighbor or your cousin or your, you know, doctor's friend's sister's wife's nephew or something before you actually start to react to it. See if there's any truth to it whatsoever. And it's a problematic thing to ask people to do because, mm-hmm. of course, when you're in the middle of a disease outbreak and you're worried about getting sick or worse, you're worried about your children getting sick, a lot of people aren't going to take the time to bother and confirm or deny these sorts of things. They're going to hear the rumor and react to it in a self-preservation mode. And the best hope that we can sort of have is to let people know, here's what often happens, and I recognize that you're going to go into the self-preservation mode, but it's a good idea as soon as you can to maybe go and find out a little bit more information about this to make certain that what you're doing is actually the right move.
Do you think people are going to do that, sir?
It's hard to tell. I'd like to believe so, yes. I know it's one of the things that I've certainly started doing since I started researching this kind of material, that I used to just send rumors on to people and act as if they were true or false, or not. Rather, I would not bother checking whether they were true or false. I would just send them along. Some of them I would, thinking of some of the things that, for example, I forwarded on to my friends when I was a college student, I now recognize were just incredibly crazy theories and weren't true at all. And then at some point when I started to get more into folklore and to study the ways that folklore works and the ways that people tell stories and how true and untrue some of these stories are, I started to question more and more of the things that arrived in my own mailboxes and inboxes. Is this story about this gas station on the other side of town where somebody taped a razor blade to the inside of the gas pump handle and the razor blade had AIDS on it and the next person who came along sliced their hand open and got AIDS? Is that actually a real story? Could that possibly happen? And one of the things that folklorists sometimes do is try to track down these kinds of rumors and see if they're true or if they're not. One of the resources that folklorists often use for this when we're trying to look at the veracity of some of these rumors is the website Snopes.com, which isn't created or maintained by folklorists, but the couple, Mickelson, I believe is their name, who run that website, do a fantastic job of tracking down rumors and seeing if they're true or false. And if you go on their website, all you have to do is click on any rumor category, and you'll immediately see that most of the rumors that they've tracked down aren't true at all. So if you hear something about X ethnicity or X disease has appeared in Y part of town somewhere, go to a media source, go to the internet, and, you know, don't look up the first conspiracy theory webpage you go to, but go to something that might be considered a more reliable, objective source, Snopes.com, CNN, or, you know, the Boston Globe, whatever your local newspaper is. Get a hold of those people and say, is this true or not?
But one of the problems is especially near the start of an epidemic or what might turn into an epidemic. Nobody seems to know anything. So all information seems to be created equal.
That's one of the major problems with a new outbreak. And it's a very frustrating point in an outbreak because medicine is doing everything that it can to try and get all of the information out. But of course, tracking a disease takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. The SARS virus, it was first announced in February, I believe it was, of 2003, had been around since at least November of 2002, but the Chinese government hadn't started talking about it yet. So the Western world became aware of the SARS virus in February of 2003, and it took at least a month or two before we finally traced the virus back to what we thought for a long time was the carrier of it, which was the Chinese civet cat, although I understand there have been subsequent studies that have traced it even further back to some kind of a horseshoe bat that might have passed it on to the civet cat via bite. But it took a long time. It took a couple of months before scientists were able to finally trace that back and say, here's where it came from. So now that we know the source, let's call all the civet cats, kill them, get them out so that they're not continuing to transmit the virus to humans. And then at least we've stopped the source. But it was 2 months of waiting around. And in that 2 month time, there were dozens and dozens of animals that were suspected and later cleared of carrying the virus. Just thinking of off the top of my head the stories that I collected, it was blamed on cockroaches, on cats, on dogs, on, I believe, pangolins, on raccoon cats. I know there were more than that. I'm just blanking on the names of the animals, but dozens of animals before we finally got it back to the civet cat. We at least knew that there was some sort of zoonotic transmission, human to animal transmission, but we didn't know which animal. And so people panicked and just started killing any animal who they thought might be problematic. There were cases in China of some of the people in, I believe it was the Guangdong province, just going out and killing dogs and cats in the streets to try and prevent the disease from being spread. And that's, again, where the problem is. When there's no official explanation or source of information, it doesn't help when medicine can only give answers like, we don't know yet, you're just going to have to wait a little bit longer for us to finish doing another round of tests. That's not a good enough answer for a lot of people.
And so people will try to seek out the answers to those questions wherever they have, even if they're not exactly correct.
They do. They very often do. And that's where the rumors start.
John, wonderful to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And we've linked to John D. Lee and his book, An Epidemic of Rumors, on our site at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be right back with Dr. Paul Offit to talk about the recent increase in vaccine-preventable illnesses after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my next guest is Dr. Paul Offit, the Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the Director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's also the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He's the author of 6 popular science books, the latest of which is Deadly Choices: How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. Good to have you here, Paul.
Thank you, Desiree.
Now, we've done a few shows on vaccines in the past, but recently we've started getting emails from listeners asking us to revisit the topic. And I think that's due to the number of vaccine-related stories that are in the news lately. So why is that, Paul? Why are we suddenly hearing so much about it again?
Well, I think my sense in the United States is that there have been outbreaks. So if you look at, I would say 90% of the media stories that are out there relate to those outbreaks, to a great extent measles, to a lesser extent whooping cough, bacterial meningitis, and mumps. And so, we've had outbreaks, I think, that have really gotten our attention. I guess my general premise on this is that we are far more compelled by fear than reason. I think people are starting to fear the diseases to some extent again.
Well, so you mentioned outbreaks. Maybe can you give us an overview of what we're seeing lately in terms of vaccine-preventable illnesses?
Sure. So for measles, we averaged about, I would say, about 130 to 150 cases of measles sort of per year over the last few years. Last year was a little bigger. Last year was 189 cases. This year, at least as of the end of March, we had 106 cases, which would project to 400 cases for the year, which would be much bigger. And, when you get to about 600 or 700 cases of measles a year, you're going to start to see measles death. So I think the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are worried about that. With regard to mumps, we just had a huge outbreak at Ohio State University. There have been outbreaks also at Richmond, at University of Richmond, associated with mumps, which I think have scared people. We had 42,800 cases of whooping cough reported last year in the United States. And given that it's underreported, that was probably just the tip of the iceberg. And about 20 to 30 children are dying every year now from whooping cough, typically in the first 2 months of life. Even bacterial meningitis is starting to make a comeback. We're seeing that on campuses as well. So I think that's really what seems to have gotten people's attention, fear.
So then what's changed? Maybe before we get to that, can you maybe give us a sense of what this all looked like pre-vaccine?
Sure. Pre-vaccine, every year there would be thousands of children who would be killed by polio and tens of thousands who would be paralyzed by polio. We'd have as many as 50,000 people a year, mostly children, who were paralyzed by polio. In the 1920s, diphtheria was the most common killer of teenagers. Rubella, which is German measles, although a very benign disease of childhood, if that virus infects the pregnant woman in her first trimester, then there's a very high chance, a greater than 85% chance, that she will deliver a child with severe birth defects.
So we aren't at pre-vaccine levels of illness then, but it is still edging back that way. So how did we get here then?
Yeah, so before vaccines, diphtheria was the most common killer of teenagers. Before vaccines, polio would paralyze as many as 50,000 people a year, mostly children, and would kill thousands. Before vaccines, measles would cause about 3 to 4 million cases a year. It would cause about 50,000 people to be hospitalized, again, mostly children, and kill about 500 people. Before vaccines, rubella or German measles virus, although a benign infection of childhood, when it that virus infected pregnant women in the first trimester, there was a very high chance of delivering children with severe eye, ear, or heart abnormalities. And there would be as many as 20,000 children born every year with severe congenital birth defects and as many as 5,000 spontaneous abortions every year caused by rubella virus. So, you know, these, I think we've forgotten about these diseases and their importance, and that's the problem. I think it's that vaccines have been a victim of their own success. It's not only that we've largely eliminated these diseases, we've eliminated the memory of these diseases, and that's why people are so cavalier.
So then how did we get here? How did we get to a point where people are finding vaccines concerning?
Because you didn't have to convince my parents to get vaccines. They saw what these diseases could do. You didn't have to convince me to get these vaccines or to give them to my children because I had many of these diseases as a child. My children have not grown up seeing these diseases, not at all. And so I think when it comes to their vaccinating their children, they're much less compelled to do it. And so I think that's it. I think vaccines have been a victim of their own success. What's happened, though, is now you're starting to see exactly what you'd expect. When you start to decrease immunization rates, the most contagious diseases come back first. And, you know, measles, whooping cough, mumps, bacterial meningitis, those are some of the most contagious diseases, especially measles. And not surprisingly, that's the ones you see come back first.
Well, it's interesting. A while back, there was I was on Facebook and somebody had posted a measles party. And I think that's one of the facets of what you're talking about, that people don't even recognize how dangerous measles is at this point because vaccines were so effective.
Yeah, you know, measles is no party. I trained in medical school in Baltimore, and there was a massive measles epidemic. I mean, during 1 year, we were just, you know, trying to deal with this on a daily basis. And, you know, children with measles are sick. When kids come into our hospital with suspected measles, they ask, you know, old people like me to come down and take a look, because I can tell in 15 seconds whether it's measles. And one of the first ways to tell is children who have measles are incredibly uncomfortable, quite ill. That's what we had to deal with. And frankly, I was in Philadelphia in 1991. It's really almost 30 years into the development of measles vaccine, where we had 1,400 cases of measles and 9 children who died, 5 of whom died in a 10-day period. And the city was in a panic when that was happening.
And how effective are these vaccines?
So effective that we've forgotten how important these diseases are. You know, they're remarkably effective. I mean, when I trained at Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh in the late 70s, early 80s, we would see, you know, the country saw 20 to 25,000 cases of Haemophilus influenza type B every year as a cause of meningitis or sepsis, meaning bloodstream infection or pneumonia. We've virtually eliminated that disease. You know, we'll see fewer than 50 cases a year. We had a child who came into our hospital, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, a few months ago. And when we listed the sort of for the fellows in our division of infectious diseases, what's the differential diagnosis of what could cause this? They actually didn't list Haemophilus influenza type B, which was probably the most common cause, you know, when I was training. So that's what we've done. We've eliminated the memory of this.
And what are the side effects
of vaccines? So certainly all vaccines that are given as shots can cause pain or redness or tenderness at the site of inoculation. Some vaccines have more severe effects. The influenza and yellow fever vaccines are made in eggs. So at least more so for the older versions of those vaccines, but people who have severe egg allergy can have an allergic reaction to those vaccines. Some vaccines like the varicella or chickenpox vaccine or the nasal spray flu vaccine are stabilized in porcine gelatin. Some people are allergic to gelatin. It's rare, but it certainly can happen. The measles-containing vaccine can cause a lowering of the platelet count called thrombocytopenia. Doesn't cause permanent sequelae, but occasionally it can cause these sort of capillary breaks, so-called petechiae, in the skin. The yellow fever vaccine, since its inception in the mid-1930s, in older people can cause systemic disease and even death. There's probably about 50 people who've died from the yellow fever vaccine in the last 70 years, but that can happen. There was an influenza vaccine that was used in Scandinavian countries and Europe that was squalene adjuvanted that caused narcolepsy, which is a sleeping disorder. We didn't use that particular vaccine in this country, so we never saw that. But so those really are the serious effects caused by vaccines, which is isn't really the problem. The problem is that people perceive vaccines to cause diseases that they don't cause, like autism or attention deficit disorder, or diabetes or multiple sclerosis or allergies or asthma, and that's just not true.
Okay, so all of those things that you just mentioned, there is a ton of misinformation about vaccines out there. So what are some of the frequently asked questions that you hear? Maybe we can clear those up for people.
I'd say the most commonly asked question is isn't this too much? I mean, aren't children just getting too many vaccines too soon? Isn't this somehow weakening or overwhelming or perturbing the immune system? And as I said before, I think you certainly anybody who watches children get five shots at once can have that feeling reasonably. But the question is it really backed by the science? I think the answer is no. I mean, when you're in in the womb, you're in a sterile environment. When you enter the birth canal in the world, you're not. And very quickly, you have living on the surface of your body trillions of bacteria. I mean, literally trillions of bacteria. I'm not trying to sound like Carl Sagan. You have, you know, about 100 trillion bacteria, 10 to the 14th bacteria that line the surface of your body. I mean, each bacterium has, depending on the size of the bacterium, has between 2,000 and 6,000 immunological components. And you make an immune response to this. I mean, you make grams of immunoglobulin A every day, grams of immunoglobulin G every day to sort of meet the challenge of the environment. Now, if you add up all the immunological components in vaccines, it's of the 14 vaccines that given in the United States, the vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases given in the United States, that all those immunological components add up to about 160. I mean, really, your challenge of vaccines is literally a drop in the ocean of what you encounter and manage every day.
Okay, I have some. There's the old, every time I get a flu shot, I get the flu statement.
Yeah, that's a common one. First of all, the flu shot is made by taking influenza virus and essentially purifying out two of the surface proteins, the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. There is not viral genome there. It is not possible for that virus to reproduce itself. Therefore, it is not possible for it to cause the flu. It can cause pain or tenderness at the injection site. And sometimes it can cause sort of, you know, this kind of a little fatigue, you know, and a little low-grade fever, feeling a little run down, but it doesn't cause the flu. I mean, the old line in medical school was that if medical students really want to know what it feels like to get sick, get flu, because that's the true influenza it knocks you on your butt. You know, you can often date the hour in which the symptoms started, usually with intense headache, fever, shaking chills. You know, you don't want to go into work. You're just stuck at home, and then it can progress to respiratory symptoms, upper respiratory tract symptoms, and then occasionally pneumonia. It's flu is different. What people say flu, I think they refer to a variety of respiratory viruses that aren't influenza. Influenza really makes you sick.
What about, I think it's important for my child to build up their immunity naturally.
Yeah, somehow the word natural has had a status that I guess I wouldn't give it. I mean, in our world, in infectious diseases, we do things like trying to prevent natural infections. I mean, polio is natural. You know, you don't want children to acquire that immunity naturally, because they may have to pay the price for that, for acquiring it naturally, which is to say paralysis or death. So I think there's nothing good about natural infections. I don't understand. It certainly is a word that has a lot of credence, but you know, it's volcanoes are natural, lice are natural. I don't see these as good things.
And of course, you mentioned autism earlier, and can you please clarify the link or lack thereof between autism and vaccines?
I certainly don't blame parents for this. I mean, parents are reasonably asked, my child was fine, they got a vaccine, now they're not fine, they have symptoms of autism, could the vaccine have done it? Fair enough. It's an answerable question. It's a testable hypothesis. You're not asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here. You're asking if someone got a vaccine, are they at greater risk of having autism than if they didn't? That question has been phrased in three different ways. First, MMR was feared to cause autism. Clearly, if you look at large numbers of children who got MMR or didn't get MMR, make sure those two groups are alike in all other aspects of healthcare or healthcare seeking behavior. MMR doesn't increase your risk from autism. So a choice not to get an MMR vaccine is only a choice to increase your risk of measles, mumps, and rubella. Then this sort of the hypothesis morphed to, you know, couldn't it be thimerosal, this ethylmercury-containing preservative vaccines? Again, these were easy studies to do, and seven studies have been done to show that's also not true. And then it kind of morphed to too many vaccines too soon. That two studies have been done showing that also is not true. So vaccines don't cause autism. I think you can safely say that vaccines are probably the best tested hypothesis of what could be a cause of autism, yet still it doesn't die. And maybe it doesn't die because we don't really know the cause or causes of autism. We don't have a clear cure or cures for autism. And until that happens, this is always going to be out there.
Okay, so what about the flu shot for healthy adults? Is that important for them to get?
Sure, because you want them to stay healthy. I mean, you know, every year about, you know, tens of thousands of adults die from influenza, and, you know, certainly hundreds of thousands are hospitalized.
Okay, so we have covered all the questions that I think everybody should already know the answer to, but does not. So now I want to get into, I think, some more opinion than fact. So what do you think about the idea that it should be mandatory for healthcare workers to get flu vaccines? Because this has been in the news a lot as well.
Well, our hospital is an example of that. Starting in 2009, we actually mandated an influenza vaccine for our healthcare workers. We defined healthcare workers anybody who could walk into the room. So not just doctors and nurses and nurse practitioners, but also, you know, unit clerks, vendors, dietary, environmental services, anybody. So that really, for our hospital, which is a big one, it meant about 10,000 people. So we mandated flu vaccine, which is to say that if you didn't get a flu vaccine, you had 2 weeks of unpaid leave to think about it. If you still didn't want to get a flu vaccine, you were fired. And the reason is we did not consider it your inalienable right to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection. We have a vulnerable population of hospitalized children, and we've had a couple children in our hospital who've come into this hospital without flu. They were cancer patients. A flu vaccine wouldn't have worked in them because they were being immunosuppressed. They depended on us to protect them. They got flu in this hospital and died as a result, and that's just not okay. And so in 2009, we finally drew a line that I think should have been drawn years earlier.
Well, also frequently in the news recently are stories about being told children being told to stay home from school that haven't been immunized.
Right. Well, I guess the question is, when do you get to the line that tells you it's time to make it so that parents really are more compelled to vaccinate their children? I mean, you know, in the old days when I was growing up, you had to get vaccines to get into school. We had fewer vaccines, but that was just the way it was. I mean, I was a child of the, you know, 50s and 60s. But starting in the 70s and 80s, in addition to medical exemptions to vaccination, we introduced things like religious exemptions and so-called philosophical or personal belief exemptions. And with that, you know, more people then were choosing not to vaccinate. And so we allowed it to happen. And in addition, you know, the diseases were, because vaccines work, were far less prevalent. So therefore more people were choosing to do that. And because of that, you're now seeing pockets of where the under vaccination rate is quite high. I mean, there are about 4 or 5 states now where the number of parents who are choosing not to vaccinate them all at all has, you know, has reached the 5% range. And those are the states where you really see these outbreaks of, you know, measles and mumps and whooping cough.
Well, I read an article just this week because we're also seeing the outbreaks in Canada. And this one was about a Manitoba mother who said that she's being bullied by her son's school because she refuses to immunize him. Are you hearing that kind of language from people?
Yes, I mean, obviously from an ethics standpoint, you would prefer to persuade rather than coerce. I think that's just better in general. But, you know, when you get to the point where, and in Canada, you guys are much worse off than we are. We'll have maybe 400 cases this year at our rate, and we're a country that's, you know, whatever, 5 times bigger than your country in population. And you've already had far more cases than we've had. Get to about 800 or 900 cases or somewhere in that range, you're going to start to see children die of measles. And is it then the right of society to coerce members who are choosing not to vaccinate for all the wrong reasons? I mean, there's no reason not to get a measles-containing vaccine. The fear that it causes autism has been clearly shown by scientific study not to be supportable. So a choice not to get a vaccine is just a bad choice. And to what extent do we let enough people make the bad choice that it puts others at risk? And remember, I mean, in our country, which is, you know, a country of about 300 million people, there are about 500,000 people who can't be vaccinated. I mean, because they're getting chemotherapy for their cancer or immune suppressive therapy for their chronic diseases, or in the case of flu, because they're less than 6 months old. Do we have any responsibility to them? I'd like to think the answer is yes, because they depend on the herd, if you will, the community, to protect them. I think what's going to happen is that we're looking at, frankly, at the natural history of an immunization program. That what will happen is, you know, people are fear the diseases. So in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you know, we were very good about vaccinating, and we eliminated measles from the United States in 2000. We eliminated rubella from the United States in 2000. 2005. We've eliminated polio from the Western Hemisphere by the late 1970s. And so what will happen is then just what you'd expect. People don't fear the diseases, so they then have these abnormal concerns about vaccine safety or false concerns about vaccine safety because they're looking for reasons not to vaccinate because it just feels wrong to them because they don't see the diseases. Then the diseases start to come back. And with that, then you see an increase in immunization rates, which I think is what's going to happen associated with these outbreaks. And then, you know, the diseases will subside because, you know, immunization will work. And then, you know, people will then become complacent. And I just think we're going to see those cycles until the sun burns out.
Oh, you are not reassuring, sir. Okay. So the options are, well, pretty much wait till it gets worse. Good. Lovely to have you here, Paul.
Just trying to cheer everybody up.
And we've included a link to Dr. Paul Offit and his latest book, Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.